So Nia, the Makba as it happens.
Tom Johnson is an American minimalist composer. A former student of Milton Feldman, his music is mainly based on the application of numerical and logical systems. His approach is unique, quite different from the free wanderings of Feldman or the repetitions and gradual processes of other American minimalists of his generation, such as Terry Riley or Steve Reich. His music is often called conceptual, but in many cases, it depends strongly on the special tempo and sound qualities of the performance with traditional instruments, such is the case of the Chord Catalogue, a 1985 piece in which the pianist plays, without omission or repetition, all possible 8,178 chords within one octave. Tom Johnson's music has a special relationship not only with numbers, but also with words. In his operas, such as the well-known The Four-Note Opera, or in the program notes that he often writes for his music, he uses words not to tell a story, but to make the listener aware of the formal structure of the piece, as well as the evolution of the performance and the process of hearing it. Sunia talks to Tom Johnson about his compositional methods and the influence that John Cage and Morton Feldman had upon it. Lessons with Morton Feldman, from paper music to listening to sounds.
I went to study with Morton Feldman after I'd already finished the master's degree at Yale. I was 28 years old, and Morty was 43. So that was only 15 years difference. And he was not very well known yet. In fact, he couldn't even get a job in the university. He didn't have university credentials. Just two or three years later, he became the great professor at SUNY Buffalo. But at this time, he was still taking students privately and trying to earn a living with as best he could. So he was happy to have a student who adored him, who had already had a lot of musical education. And we had a very nice relationship. I used to go to his apartment when I had enough money to pay him because I was earning my living as an accompanist for modern dance classes, which is also what John Cage did when he was a young composer. So I didn't have a lot of money. But when I had $15, that was a lot of money at that time, I would call Morty and go take a lesson. And he was very open, and I thought I wanted to learn about chance music because that's what everybody was talking about. But he said, well, we can talk about chance, but, you know, I think we need to talk about sound. You know, you guys in the university, you learn all this theory and you can put notes on paper, but sometimes you don't hear very well. And of course, he was absolutely right. I was writing paper music like most graduate students. And we started from that. And he really made me listen to everything. Every lesson was at the piano. Listen to this. Wouldn't it have been a little better in this octave instead of the other octave, the bass voice, and things like that. So it was wonderful, 2 years with him. I think I really became a composer. I didn't really know who I was or what my music was before that. It turned out to be rather different from Morty's music because I remember about 3 years afterwards, I says, well, you know, I got a confession to make, Mr. Feldman. I think I still called him Mr. Feldman. You know, I'm going back to systems. I have logical systems in my music now, and you were always against that. He smiled. He said, I knew you were going to do it, but it was good for you for a while to work without any systems, just to listen to the sound. And of course, it was very good. I needed that very, very much. He was a wise teacher.
Being around the maverick.
We talked about John Cage, too, who was very active in New York at this time. And in fact, John Cage was really the model for all of my generation of the young composers, because he was the maverick, you know. He was the iconoclast who didn't have any respect for Beethoven and Boulez, and he just wanted to do something, start from zero. And he was, his model was, musically, was Charles Ives, Henry Cowell, the rugged individuals, the American image. We're going to make an American music and something new, something different, something not just coming from European traditions. So he was very important in that way, and he was unusual for older distinguished composers. He had an interest for the younger generation. That's very rare among old distinguished composers. He actually came to our concerts rather regularly, and he wanted to talk to us, and he would give us his opinions if we asked, and so forth. And he was a wonderful man, very generous. John was, he had more friends than anybody I ever met. He had friends all over the world, not just composers, but musicians, the dancers, the festival organizers, everybody he ever met. He remembered the name, and he knew the people, and he loved his, all of his friends. Feldman was very different. He didn't go to concerts hardly ever. He just stayed home and wrote his music. He was a loner, kind of in another way. He was a model, too, for me. But I think with Feldman, the model was learn how to work, learn how to be yourself, and learn how to listen. And the Cage was a model because learn how to live, to be generous, to open, have an interest in other people, go to lots of concerts, be out there. This is what I took from Cage. Anyway, it was a very fortunate heritage for a young composer to have, to be in close contact with two giants of the generation before.
From New York to Paris.
In the 80s, American minimal music became very fashionable in Europe, especially after the success of Einstein on the Beach, but other things too, and ensembles were getting invited to Europe. I had a new piece called Nine Bells, which was a performance I did on an instrument that I had invented with nine bells hanging from the ceiling. This was a bizarre thing for Europeans and very minimal. Well, they were really interested. So I booked my first tour in Europe in 1979. I had 10 different concerts in 6 different countries. So this was a real good introduction to Europe. And after that, I made a lot of contacts and I was getting much more work in Europe than I had in the United States. And then I had a D grant in Berlin for 3 months and another residency in Paris for 5 months. And so I was starting to work on my German and my French and finding Europe very stimulating. And I decided it didn't make sense to continue buying tickets to go back to New York. I might as well just stay here. So I finally found an apartment in Paris that I bought in 1983, little place. And I've been living in Paris ever since. I had no particular love for Paris. In fact, I had more contacts in West Berlin and Cologne at the time. Those were also places where I might have been able to live. But Paris was big and noisy and dirty and centrally located, and it reminded me of New York. And I felt very at home there. I had also a very good old friend, Eliane Radigue, who was liked very much. She's the only French minimalist, really. We had met in New York in 1971. And we're kind of a loners as minimalists in France are concerned. I've always called myself a minimalist, everything I've ever done. It's not repetitive music, it's not drone music, but it's minimal in one way or another. So it's kind of lonely in France, and most French critics and ensembles don't really understand my approach at all. But that's okay, because I have a lot of work in Holland and Germany, England, different places, Spain fairly often. Since I moved to Europe in 1983, I've been able to earn my living just with my music. Before that, I was writing articles and doing music journalism, and as I mentioned, accompanying modern dance classes and doing different things. But now I could just do my music, which I continue to do.
The logic we can hear
So little by little, my music became more mathematical. I had never studied mathematics, but I was very interested in logical sequences. And I wanted music that made sense, music that I could follow, that where each note had to be what it had to be, not just arbitrary choices that came from dreams and desires and emotions and all of these other things that other composers were interested in. But I had to do it simply since I didn't know any mathematics. So I did things like 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 3, 4, 4, 4, 4, 5, 5, 5, 5, 5. Then I started with my nine bells. I put the nine bells hung from the ceiling in a square, 3x3. And then you sort of ask, how can I walk around a 3x3 grid in a logical way? So you can make the little squares within the big square, and you can make go around the outside, or you can make a clover leaf. You can do all these different geometries within a 3x3 grid. But that was logical sequences too, but in a visual geometrical sense. And then little by little, I went a bit further. I decided to read Euclid, which I had never read before. And the number theory of Euclid is very interesting. I got some ideas out of that. And I went back to Pascal's triangle, which actually a teacher in high school had explained to us once, but I never paid much attention to Pascal's triangle. But it's a wealth of, it's a beautiful mathematical model that contains not only the logic of all the combinations of one and zero and things like that, heads and tails. Well, I wrote a couple of pieces with Pascal's triangle. And then little by little, I became interested in other things. It's curious. This is not mathematics to be complicated. This is not like the serialist who did very elaborate systems, or Brian Ferneyhough, who has a very elaborate system, sometimes mathematical, in order to obscure the music. This is mathematics in order to make very clear. 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 3, 4, 4, 4, 4. You can predict that. It's predictable music. Sometimes my music isn't easy to predict, but you can often sense that there is a predictable logic. If I say, for example, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, you sense there's a logic. If I ask you to explain exactly what I did, you probably wouldn't be able to say immediately, well, it's a color of 1, 2, 3, 4 and a talia that goes tong, 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 rest, tong, 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 rest. But you heard it, and you could sing with me, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. That's an example of how something can be a little bit too complicated to really analyze and understand, but you can hear it. And that's been point of departure for most of my music, to try to make predictable sequences that people can hear.
Music which explains itself.
I've always liked music that I could understand. In fact, when I write a sketch of something and I can't really hear it, can't really understand, then I throw it away, because I want music that's clear. And I always write program notes, sometimes rather extensive program notes, so that people know what the process was that I was using, if there's a mathematical sequence or something. And the latest CD is a violinist named Andrew McIntosh from Los Angeles, and we decided to call the album Correct Music. This is particularly because there's a piece on the album called Squares, which is subtitled Didactic Music for a Solo Player. And these are Latin squares, but they explain, there's a narration that goes with it, that explains what a Latin square is, a mathematical idea that came from Leonhard Euler. At one point in this piece, I think it's fifth variation, he stops, he says, uh-oh, there was a wrong note. You probably heard it. But we don't want wrong notes in this piece, so I'm going to redo the fifth variation with the correct notes. And he does. And of course, it does sound much better with the correct notes, because there's supposed to be nine different notes in each phrase. And in the incorrect version, there were only seven different notes. The two were repeated. And doesn't sound good if you get used to this other thing. So that's an example of music which explains itself within the performance. The performer has to play the wrong notes and then observe that they were the wrong notes.
Being aware of the process of listening.
Uwe Schleich's The hour for piano because of the program notes, and you read the program notes at the same time as you listen to the music, and it helps you concentrate. It also makes you very aware of how you listen and how you read, and where is your attention going. There's another piece that does that very much, which is called Music and Questions, 120 permutations of a five-note sequence, and after each sequence, there's another question, such as, are you listening more to the music or to the questions? So, how are you listening? What are you listening to? And I like to make people aware that they are listening and they are thinking and maybe counting and whatever they are doing, whatever the process is. Because I always think that I appreciate music if I am aware of what I'm doing, if I'm aware of what I'm listening to. And this makes a deeper communication, I think.
The conscious performer.
It's not only a question of being conscious of what you're hearing and how your brain is working, but that the performer is conscious of what he is doing and where he is. A good example of that, well, I was very influenced by Pirandello's Six Characters in Search of an Author. That's a case where the actors are very conscious that they are actors and they want to be themselves, not just follow the slaves of some writer and so forth. So you get all of this metaphysics of theater in there, and I love that piece. I didn't do the same thing, but something a little bit similar in the four-note opera, because here there are no characters. The characters are called the soprano, the alto, the tenor, and the bass, and the baritone. And they're quite conscious, and they have who they are. And the big tenor aria is a lament because it's unfair, so unfair, because the tenor only has one aria, and all the other soloists have two or three. Isn't it a shame? Because if I had one or two more arias, I could sing them so well. I could sing them so well. So there he is. He's the typical tenor who is vain and he wants to have the glory and he's not getting it here, and he asks you to feel sorry for him. There are other moments where the baritone says, this is the long aria, nobody's going to pay attention to it, and I have to, thankless job that I have to sing this aria. So you feel sorry for him at another time. And then the soprano, she explains that composer said she could sing this aria wherever she wants. So that's why we have the garden scene, because I like to sing in the garden. And so the soprano gets to express her desire. Or in another case, she's going to do the balcony scene, or the she's on her deathbed, or whatever she wants to do. They usually like opera cliches like that. So this is being conscious not only of the music, but of the situation. Who are these people? Why are they there? What is their relationship with the composer? What's the relationship between the character and the performer and the composer? And if you are forced to think about this a little bit, this is another way of opening up the metaphysics of what's happening and increasing interest in the event, which is a performance.
The algebra of notes.
You know, it's interesting with mathematics. I have friends who are mathematicians and computer scientists who can't understand why I want to still write for instruments, because you can do this so much more precisely with MIDI and with computers, and you get it exact, and then you don't have to worry about performers making mistakes and everything. I can't do that, and that may be the influence of Morton Feldman, because he loved these instruments so much. You know, the difference between the piccolo and the flute is subtle, but it's very important. And sometimes you want one, sometimes you want the other. And all of these things, talking about the instrument, which instrument. And this is what music is these instruments, this great European tradition that even renegade American composers have to respect. So I can't get away from that. And I don't even like microtonal music. You can do that on a flute or a violin, quarter tones and sixth tones and things, but it always sounds out of tune to me. I don't like it. It's not the tradition. It's not. Another thing about my music is that I decided I'm interested in notes and not sounds. There's a big difference. I remember a discussion I used to have with Gerard Griset before he died. He was a spectral music composer, and he was only interested in sound. He wrote an article once, I discovered when I was young that music is not about notes, it's about sound. Well, this is very moving to read this and you think, ah, this is a man who's really after truth. But was he really finding truth? Because what is a sound? A sound is something, I don't hear it the way you hear it. It's not going to sound the same in one part of the hall as in another part of the hall. It's not going to sound the same if it's there's more humidity or less humidity. It's certainly not going to sound the same on one violin as on another violin, or in one soprano's voice as opposed to another soprano's voice. So what are you talking about? You're talking about something that's totally arbitrary, a sound. But if I say C sharp, quarter note, this octave, that's indisputable. That's going to always be C sharp, quarter note, this octave. So I like, it's algebra. We're not talking about undefinable stuff. We're talking about algebra, things completely defined. And I can work with completely defined things. And in fact, it's very hard to be logical with undefined things. You have to define them before you can do a sequence.
Kenneth Goldsmith.
Music for 88 is simply Johnson citing mathematical theorems and then demonstrating them on piano. It's a preposterous idea, and it's dry as dust to boot. And in an oblique way, it's quite beautiful. That is, if you take it on its own terms. But in the Johnsonian aesthetic, that's the point. There is no way to take his music but on its own terms. Trying to apply conventional thinking to his projects is useless.
That's a nice quote of Goldsmith. He understood something very important about my music. It's music about itself. It's not about the ideas. It's not about emotions. It's just about doing what it has to do. I sometimes say I want to find the music, not to compose it. This, of course, comes from Marcel Duchamp's theory. The found object is the beautiful thing, not something I invented, but something I found. And the multiplication table, for take one example out of the music for 88, is something that I found. Everybody finds. It's just there. A good example of that came up just recently in Dublin. There was a string quartet named Contempo, young Romanian string players, wonderful quartet. Won lots of prizes in there. You're going to be hearing concerts of Contempo for many years to come, I think. But they were engaged to play the formulas of Tom Johnson, which is a piece from 1993, and which had been played by the Brindisi Quartet, but maybe not as precisely and with the conviction that Contempo gave it. And the performance that night was stunning. Everybody said, but this music is so emotional. Well, why was it emotional? Just because it was so correct and with such conviction. These musicians, they understood this is music about itself. This is not music where we have to add expression. This is not, in fact, I went to a rehearsal and they added a couple of things. They wanted in the middle of one movement to suddenly start playing Ponticello. I said, no, why are you changing? It was just so beautiful up to that point. It doesn't need any decoration, any change. They understood exactly. And they played it again from beginning to end with no change. No change in tempo, no change in dynamics, no change in anything. And it was beautiful. And the performance went like that. Every movement was exactly like a machine, but a machine that was human, that was convicted, that was convinced that it had to be that way. So mathematics is not cold. People think mathematics is cold, but it's not. When it's done, you watch somebody working on his computer program, if they still do that. Now the software is so good, you don't have to do much programming anymore. But if you see somebody who's working on a tough problem and it's going to take him a couple hours and you watch the concentration, that's not cold. That's human. And that's the depth of what this logic is about.
The challenge of playing like a machine.
I should add that I'm not completely against machines. In fact, I've written some machine music. I have a good friend, collaborator in Berlin named Martin Riches, who makes beautiful machines. He has a wooden clock that works with a pendulum, for example. No electricity at all. It keeps perfect time. It's amazing. He's a craftsman who can do beautiful things. He also has an automatic flute, which I love. It makes a beautiful sound. It only has a one octave range because with the mechanical mouth, you can't get it to do different octaves. But it does one octave beautifully. And it reads scores on transparent strips that go under the little, get read by the machine. And I wrote pieces that I call reversibles. There were, I think, 7 different strips that go through the machine in 4 different directions. They can go and come and be turned over and go and come. So you get 4 pieces out of each 30-second strip. I love this idea, and this has been successful. These pieces are played often. And it's very nice to see the machine that is able to turn these music around better than a human being would be able to. Then later I wrote for player piano. I have a couple of pieces for player piano. There I was able to do curves with a precision that human pianists wouldn't be able to play because they not only go up and down, but they make gradual retards and accelerandos according to the computer, so it makes perfect curves. But 3 times, at least, people have wanted to do computer programs for the chord catalog. Martin Riches had one with he has an automatic organ that played like a bat out of hell. It was so fast, and the chord's absolutely perfect. But instead of taking 1 hour, he got through the chord catalog in about 20 minutes. But the audience was all gone after 3 minutes. There was just no interest in watching a machine go through these changes that are so easy for the machine. When I played it, people would sit there for an hour to make sure that I could really do it and to make sure I didn't make mistakes. It's very different when there's a human being playing the chord catalog. Clarence Barlow did another version with a MIDI file on the Yamaha disc clavier. The disc clavier reads MIDI files. But there he had a problem because at that time, this is before 2000, I think, and the disc clavier, Yamaha disc clavier, could not read chords of more than 6 notes. That was too much for the memory of this machine. So he could only go up to the 6-note chords. He couldn't play this 8-note chords and the 9-note chords and everything. Now you can. I think the disc claviers have bigger memories now, and you can go all the way to the 13-note chord. Wolfgang Heisig is another composer who makes his own paper rolls. He can stamp paper rolls, a machine that reads MIDI. And he does wonderful work in player pianos. He's done all of the Nan Caro things and some of his own pieces, and he's taken some Tom Johnson pieces and other people and does it. But the chord catalog, he also can't play the whole thing and expect the audience to want to listen. But now the human performers have really advanced, and there's a young man, composer, who's also studied quite a bit of mathematics and is a very fine pianist, named Samuel Vriesen. He's Dutch, he lives in Amsterdam, and he can play the whole chord catalog in 28 minutes. Incredible. He's got this computer in his fingers that just goes, doesn't make any mistakes. It's amazing. Nobody walks out on that. You can't believe. It's a phenomenon. And if people are walking out on the computer, but they're not going to walk out on Samuel Vriesen.
Macba.cat